This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young, and we've been following the aftermath of the Las Vegas massacre. President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump held a moment of silence in the last hour, lowering the White House flag to half-staff to acknowledge the mass shooting in Las Vegas. At least 58 people dead, 515 injured after the gunman, 64-year-old Stephen Paddock, shot multiple rounds into a crowd at an outdoor country concert, the worst mass shooting in recent U.S. history. Casey Morell of member station KNPR is in Las Vegas. And Casey, I just want to listen to a little sound. Over the course of the day, we've been hearing from different people, including recently the suspect's brother, Eric Paddock, who lives in Orlando, Florida. He's completely shocked. He said it's like Mars fell on his family, shocked that his brother might have done this and had so many weapons. Here's a little of Eric Paddock on CNN.
He was a wealthy guy, and he liked to play video poker. He went on cruises. He sent his mother cookies from, big, huge, crazy boxes of cookies.
Casey, Eric Paddock also acknowledged that the Paddock father, Benjamin Paddock, was a bank robber. He was on the FBI's most wanted list, but they said they weren't, weren't proud of that. They didn't know him. But how are people there in Las Vegas reacting to finding out about the shooter?
Well, Robin, I think that it's all just part of the sense of numbness and shock that I think a lot of people here in Southern Nevada are feeling. One of the interesting things in our own coverage here on KNPR, we took calls from listeners earlier this morning to talk about what their reactions were, and a woman who identified herself as a Muslim said that she was glad that the gunman was a white person and not a Muslim of color, because she feared the backlash against her and her children if the gunman had to happen to have been a person of color.
Well, and in fact, the brother said the gunman had, to the brother's knowledge, no political or religious affiliation. So there's that.
Yeah, although we're also hearing, or at least we were hearing earlier today, a claim of responsibility from ISIS, which hasn't been confirmed. And the FBI says there's no connection to international terrorism. But what more do we know about his motivations?
That's a good question, Jeremy. The police have ransacked his house in Mesquite, where he lived. Mesquite, about 90 minutes to the northeast of Las Vegas. They executed a search warrant there earlier this morning, found more weapons and more ammunition. There might have been things there that they found that help us understand why this happened. But if that's the case, the police haven't really been sharing that as of yet. Mm-hmm. I think they might be waiting for the full investigations to take place before they try to render any judgment as to why he did this.
Yeah. Casey, what's the latest there where you are? There were phone numbers earlier today to call if you were missing a family member, phone numbers to call if you have video from last night. So are the people who've, died, are they been identified? What's going on?
Some of the people who were killed have been identified. Some of the victims who were shot otherwise have been identified as well. Amongst some of those who were taken to hospitals, a series of off-duty police officers from California who were in town for the concert. Los Angeles Police Department, San Diego Police Department, Bakersfield Police Department telling us and telling KQED earlier today that they had victims in their ranks. Of people who were there. Canadian media have reported that a couple of Canadians were amongst the dead. I've seen chatter from media in Iceland that there were Icelandic tourists who were caught up in this as well. So it seems as though the pool of victims really reflects the fact that Las Vegas is a very international city.
I'm sure that people there who were there or people who live there in Las Vegas are still in a kind of a state of shock right now. I must say, we're all a bit in a state of shock when you look at 58 people dead in this shooting, at least, and 500 plus injured. We've got NPR's Tom Gelton with us. And Tom, I was looking at the other big mass shootings in recent U.S. history, and You know, 49 killed in Orlando at the Pulse nightclub, and in Virginia Tech, that was 32 people killed in that one. And of course, what happened in Newtown, Connecticut, 20 children and 6 adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School. This is more dead than all of those.
That's right, Jeremy. Just a few more dead than were killed in Orlando at the Pulse shooting. But still, it certainly stands out. I mean, we've been very careful to on NPR to say it's the biggest mass shooting in recent, in modern U.S. history, because there sadly were a number of cases in the past when there were much bigger massacres that have taken place. But certainly in, the last 50 years, this really stands out.
Well, and what do we know about it? What do we know about the guns that were said to be found in the hotel room where, you know, officials burst in, lawmakers burst in, and Paddock had already killed himself? Did he legally own them? His brother, again, we're hearing from his brother things about Stephen Paddock, that he had airplanes and he had a hunting license from Alaska. But do we know if he legally owned the guns?
We haven't heard that information yet. We did hear from, as you say, from his brother, Eric Paddock. He didn't know that he had anything like this collection of long rifles. He said he knew he had a couple of handguns. That's all he knew. Of course, who knows whether Eric Paddock, living in Orlando, Florida, you know, is up to date with what his brother in California has, but Nevada has. But still, that was apparently a surprise to him. We do know, of course, from what the police, the law enforcement authorities have said, that when they broke into that hotel room in Las Vegas, they found more than 10 long rifles there. So he came up with them somewhere. You know, we've also heard from law enforcement authorities that they had had no contact with him prior to this, no recent arrest record, nothing to sort of put him on their radar. So we don't have any information that he acquired those guns illegally, but it's one of those questions that we're going to be looking for answers to in the coming days.
We spoke a few minutes ago with somebody who was on the scene there last night, a photographer named Dennis Guerrero. I want to just listen to a little bit of what he told us.
I looked behind me and I told the gentleman and his wife, I go, was that a gunshot? And he goes, I think it was. And the lady next to him said, oh, no, it's fireworks for the show. And then that's when the automatic fire started. And that doesn't sound like any fireworks on the planet.
Casey Morell, we're hearing a lot of people who thought that it was fireworks at first. And in fact, even Dennis told us that once they discovered it was gunshots coming at them, they couldn't tell from where. They thought that the shooter was in the crowd, not up in the building above them.
Right. Well, if you consider, you know, just the layout of the area there, where the festival ground was in relation to where Mandalay Bay is, you know, you're kind of penned in when you're at the festival grounds. There aren't that many places to enter and exit because you're surrounded on a couple of sides by roadways, and to the back is McCarran International Airport. I also think that probably if you hear gunfire, your first instinct isn't to look up and to think that it might be coming from above you. So when people started hearing it and realized that it was gunfire, I think your first instinct is to duck and look around you, not to necessarily look up at a building like
that. Well, Casey, but what happens now? I mean, this has been something that's been a security analyst's nightmare since the Ariana Grande concert, when people realized you could have screening to go into the venue, which they had at this concert last night and they had at her concert. But then that will push the attacker on the perimeter. And that's what we have here, somebody shooting from the perimeter. It's early days, but is anyone talking about screening in hotels? Or, I mean, they do that during the Boston Marathon, for instance. Now, you can't get into certain buildings along the route unless you have identification that you work there. But how do you do that with a hotel?
That's a great question, Robin. And when you consider, too, that, you know, how think of a Las Vegas hotel. You know, it has not only the hotel, but it has shops, it has restaurants, it has nightlife, it has gaming. You could be there for any one of those reasons. You could be there just to marvel at the interior, the architecture inside. So if you start trying to say, well, only people with legitimate reasons can be here, I don't know how you'd go about defining that. But there's definitely been talk of you know, heightening security at the different entrances to casinos on the Strip. I think that we're probably going to see an increased police presence no matter what in the coming days. But whether we get to the point where metal detectors are placed at every, you know, entrance and exit, I don't know if we're there.
Well, and it's legal to carry a machine gun in Nevada. It's an open carry state, so you could have walked in with them. But anyway.
That's Casey Morell of station KNPR in Las Vegas. And we've also been speaking with NPR correspondent Tom Jelton, following the latest from Las Vegas. 58 dead, more than 500 injured. We will keep following this. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks.
You bet.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the mass shooting in Las Vegas. At least 58 people are dead, more than 500 injured after a gunman opened fire on an outdoor country music concert from the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel last night. It is the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history. Earlier today, President Trump spoke of his plans to visit Las Vegas this week.
On Wednesday morning, very early, we're going to be leaving for Las Vegas, where we're going to be seeing the governor, who I just spoke to, the mayor, governor of the state, the mayor of Las Vegas, who I just spoke to, the sheriff, who has done such a great job. The police department has done such a fantastic job in terms of the speed, and we all very much appreciate it.
Joining us now is NPR's White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, just in the last hour, the president and the first lady went outside at the White House and held a moment of silence.
That's right. Just about 40 minutes ago, President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence, joined by Melania Trump and Karen Pence, left the residence, walked out onto the South Lawn where a lot of White House staffers had already assembled. There were some chiming bells, and then they stood there for a moment of silence in honor of those who were killed today. The White House is calling this a day for mourning and reflection, but there are some others here in Washington who believe silence is not the correct response. We have a letter from Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader in the House of Representatives, who points out that this is, even though this is the deadliest shooting in modern history, this is just one of nearly 300 mass shootings we've had in 2017.
Right.
And she's urging the House Speaker, Paul Ryan, to appoint a select committee on gun violence and is one of the first acts to pass the King-Thompson bill. That's a bipartisan bill from Republican Peter King and Democrat Mike Thompson that would close some of the loopholes in the background check system. Although, of course, given what we know about the shooter in this case, it's not clear that that would have made any difference in this instance.
There doesn't seem to be anything in his background.
No red flags that would have, you know, caused him to fail a background check.
That we can see now. Of course, others are calling for, you know, taking a closer look again at these long rifles that can be made to be assault-like rifles. And it sounds from the shooting that that's what these were. But here's some more of the tweets and requests. Hillary Clinton tweeting, "Our grief isn't enough. We must put politics aside, stand up to the NRA." Former astronaut Mike Kelly and his wife, former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, who, of course, was shot and almost killed, say thoughts and prayers aren't going to stop the next shooting. But you got to wonder, Scott, if Congress didn't address that law and change things after Sandy Hook, you know, children slaughtered or the Pulse nightclub shooting, why would they do it now?
Right. That was one of the great frustrations of former President Obama's second term. Of course, he pushed very hard, spent a lot of political capital trying to get tougher background checks like what's called for under the King-Thompson bill through the Senate. Had a majority in the Senate, but not enough to break a filibuster. If it couldn't pass then with a Democratic Senate, it's hard to imagine it passing right now with Republicans in the majority.
Scott, as you know, as somebody who covers the White House, even when an event as horrific as what we just saw in Las Vegas happens, there are a lot of other things going on at the same time, things we probably would have been talking about today if it weren't for what happened in Las Vegas. But one of them is the ongoing situation in Puerto Rico. And the president is still planning to go to Puerto Rico tomorrow?
That's right. There were a lot of questions as news of just the scale of this shooting in Las Vegas came across today, about whether the president would in fact stick to that itinerary and visit Puerto Rico as scheduled tomorrow, and he is planning to do so. Of course, there has been some criticism of the scale of the federal response to the disaster left by Hurricane Maria. So President Trump will travel there tomorrow, show the flag, encourage those who are trying to deal with the aftermath of the storm there. Of course, over the weekend, he was having a bit of a Twitter spat with the mayor of San Juan. Mm-hmm. She has complained about the federal response. He complained about her, saying she'd been guilty of a lack of leadership, and also suggesting that there were some partisan ingrates in Puerto Rico who were not duly grateful for the federal help they've gotten, such as it is.
Well, she did say, you know, you are killing us with the inefficiency. It kind of started, I think, when the acting Homeland Security head said, this is a good news story. And then the mayor of San Juan said, it is not a good news story. You are killing us with inefficiency. And then, as you said, President Trump tweeting out at her. But also, you know, he was speaking directly to people in Puerto Rico saying there should be a community response here, kind of seeming to imply that the people in Puerto Rico were just sitting around and waiting for help, as opposed to people in Houston who got up and worked hard. We spoke to people in Puerto Rico who said it's a complete community effort. Everybody's out there, you know, helping everybody else, cleaning up. You know, he's going to be going there. I mean, at least he's scheduled to go there now after having told them that they aren't really helping themselves. How do you think that's going to go?
It's going to be an interesting reaction. It'll be interesting to see who's there to meet him on the tarmac when he lands in Puerto Rico. He also talked about meeting there with the leaders from the Virgin Islands. He initially hoped to visit the Virgin Islands, but it looks like just logistically that's not going to happen tomorrow. So he'll meet with officials from both places in Puerto Rico. We have heard from our NPR reporters on the ground of some progress being made, painfully slowly, and one of the arguments the president has made is, look, the damage from Maria was so vast and the infrastructure so damaged that it has made it challenging to bring in supplies, and that's undoubtedly true. Mm-hmm. There's also been criticism, though, that the logistical skills of the Defense Department, which are, you know, they're the folks with the wherewithal to do this kind of thing,
right,
were not employed quickly enough and strongly enough given the magnitude of the storm. Mm-hmm.
That's NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
And we will continue to follow the shooting in Las Vegas and bring you the latest as we get it. But let's turn now to some news going on all the way on the other side of the world in Catalonia in Spain. The region's leaders say the Spanish region won the right to independence in yesterday's election that was marred by violence. Hundreds injured as riot police attacked people at polling stations. Joining us now is the BBC's Gavin Lee. He's on the busy streets of Barcelona. And Gavin, what are people there saying today? Do they really think this means independence?
I think it feels for a lot of people, certainly the activists and voters who turned out at the polling stations for the ban referendum, believe that there is a momentum now when it comes to what happens in the next couple of days. In a way that people here who, for decades, who've been chasing this dream of breaking off, that they have now. And I think there are two facts just to look at here. One is the fact that they were extremely defiant, and certainly the separatist parties in the face of the Spanish government, to try to take this vote on, even though it was banned, it's against the constitution. Secondly, you know, the scenes that have appeared all over the world from these images of police violence against people essentially trying to go to the ballot box, trying to vote and keep the ballot box, you know, it looks ostensibly as David and Goliath, you know, this real brutality to some old women. I saw as well people being pulled by the hair, being stamped on by Spanish police, being pushed back because they were in the way of the ballot boxes which police needed to seize because the orders were from the Spanish government that this vote mustn't go ahead. But it's far more complicated, complex, because if you think about it, if we're to go off the results from the Catalan president, Carles Puigdemont, who said 2 million people in Catalonia voted, 90% of them said yes. We have no idea how it got to that vote. There's no sense of a legitimate way of counting. But if we are to go with that, that means more than half the population didn't vote. Many people said they were staying indoors, and they're frightened, frankly, of how divisive this... I think... I don't like to use any superlatives, but I think these are really unprecedented moments now for the next 48 hours.
Well, how is the Spanish government responding today, not just to what looks like this vote for independence in Catalonia, but also to how they treated voters yesterday?
Well, I think they've taken a singular line led by the Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy, which is that all the way through, this vote shouldn't have taken place. And they place the blame firmly on the separatist parties and the president, Carlos Puigdemont, to say that he ultimately duped people into what is a referendum that doesn't count, that's got no legitimacy. They talk about, for example, in the UK, that the British Prime Minister, if she were to say no to a Scottish referendum and that were to take place, it's inciting people who had been fooled into this, and that the police were acting proportionately. Now, they're saying that despite images, you know, video footage, despite what we've seen, which shows, you know, old women, who, one of which I've spoken to from hospital bed this morning, an 80-year-old woman who has a huge cut on her head. I think where this goes as well, Mariano Rajoy is meeting with the President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker. And the European Union has a role here because, you know, Spain is a member of the European Union. The Catalan president is saying that he wants to talk as almost as a go-to with the EU, but the EU are saying at the moment that the constitution was broken, but violence must not occur. So I think it's a fairly light-handed approach from the EU at the moment, trying to stay away, but also aware that there's many other successionist places across Europe. You know, you've got Flanders in Belgium, you've got the Basque Country in Spain, you've got the Scottish population as well. This is not a good moment for the EU either. So I think they are trying to stay to one side of this with the Spanish government, but against violence.
But today, the end result of all of this, Catalonia still part of Spain.
In 48 hours, Carlos Puigdemont will decide whether or not to unilaterally declare independence. If that happens, the Spanish government says it will invoke Article 155 as the constitution, which will take over the Catalan government. So we are in unprecedented times for the next 2 days. I think Wednesday morning, most people here will have more of an idea of where on earth we go from here.
That's the BBC's Gavin Lee joining us from Barcelona. Gavin, thank you.
All the best.
And you're listening to special coverage from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the massacre in Las Vegas. The shooting suspect, Stephen Paddock, in a room on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel, from which he unloaded into the crowd of 22,000 concertgoers below. Police found 10 long rifles in the room after Paddock shot himself. Casey Morell of member station KNPR in Las Vegas has been covering the story with us. Casey, start with you. The big question all day has been why. Any more answers to that question since we last spoke?
Not really, Robin. I mean, investigators are still trying to figure out what Stephen Paddock's motivation was. We heard from his brother earlier today, who seemed as confused and as stunned as the rest of us as to how this atrocity could take place. You know, police have been combing through his house to try to figure out if there's anything there that might lend some insight into what happened. If they've found anything, they haven't shared it yet.
Casey, do we know how long it took police to get to that hotel room where he was?
From what I understand, the first calls of reports of shots fired near Mandalay Bay came in around 10 o'clock Sunday night Pacific time. At that point, from what we understand, from what Las Vegas Metropolitan Police said later in the night earlier this morning, by about 10:30 Pacific time, the situation was neutralized. And in the words of Sheriff Joe Lombardo, the suspect had expired.
Yeah. Look, I want to bring in NPR's Tom Gelton, national desk correspondent. He's with us as well. And Tom, I'm listening to Casey. I can't imagine being in the rooms on either side of the shooters' rooms. This noise was just horrendous. But there's been kind of quiet from officials. We were hearing press conferences all day, every couple of hours. We haven't heard from them in a while. Do you have a sense of what's going on there?
Well, I think they're, one of the things they're trying to do is locate his and talk to his girlfriend, who might have some information about what was in his mind in these last few days. I wanted to throw something else out, Robin, and that is, you know, earlier today, ISIS made this very strange claim that he had, that Paddock had converted to Islam and that he was an ISIS soldier. And that got a lot of attention because it's been fairly rare for ISIS to claim connection to terrorist incidents it really had no connection to. Not unheard of, but rare. But two strong points. Not only has the FBI said it saw no such connection, his brother said he had no religious affiliation. We have also heard that Stephen Paddock was a gambler, liked to play video poker, and he shot himself before the law enforcement came into the scene. Gambling and suicide are big no-nos in jihadi circles. So I think we have to emphasize there is zero evidence that he had any connection to ISIS before that goes any further.
The hope is the hope that we hear from jihadis is that you are martyred, that somebody else kills you. And the only there have been pictures floating around from Stephen Paddock's Facebook, and it shows him kind of woozy and bleary-eyed and drinking. so there's all that. Jeremy, I know you're going to jump in.
Well, Casey, you know, it's been now more than 12 hours since all of this happened. How are things right now in Las Vegas?
I think that, you know, people are still processing. They're still trying to figure out why. They're still trying to figure out what exactly happened. One of the most, I think, interesting things that we've seen is that the lines at blood banks here in Southern Nevada have been hours long. And the Red Cross and other officials have told people, if you want to donate blood, get an appointment, because don't show up today, you're not going to get in. The people have turned out in such numbers just for something like that. We heard reports of people going of their own volition to the shelter that was set up at the Thomas and Mack Center, the basketball arena last night, you know, with snacks, with blankets, things like that, just to comfort people who were there. I think that we're all just shocked.
Casey Morell, member station KNPR in Las Vegas, NPR National Desk correspondent Tom Gelton helping us with our special coverage of the Las Vegas massacre. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Here's what we know about the shooting last night at an outdoor concert in Las Vegas. 58 people are dead, more than 500 injured. President Trump called it an act of pure evil. He will pay a visit to Las Vegas on Wednesday. Investigators say the suspect, 64-year-old Stephen Paddock, killed himself in the hotel room from which he had been shooting. They say he acted alone and had no connections to international terrorism. There are, of course, still many unanswered questions, including what it means for security at these kinds of large events. Russ Simons is managing partner at Venue Solutions Group. He joins us on Skype from Brentwood, Tennessee. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
And what did you think as you saw this unfolding as an expert in live event security?
I thought that every time we think we've seen everything that could happen, we're wrong, and we should never be thinking that again.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that the things that we used to feel were beyond comprehension are now happening on a daily basis. I mean, just the day before, on Sunday, we had attacks in France and attacks in Edmonton, Alberta, followed by this horrific incident on Sunday night. And almost the pace of what's happening now is also overwhelming.
What about the attack itself? I mean, when you look at what happened there, somebody standing on a high floor of a hotel and shooting out the window at a crowd down below, is there any way to prepare for something like that?
I don't think there's any way to prepare for that. On the other hand, it's not something that's new. Ever since the unfortunate shootings at the University of Texas many, many years ago, there have been incidents with people who have taken high ground for this purpose. I think that it's not unique, but the scale of it is beyond comprehension.
So as an expert on security at these kinds of events, what would you suggest to concerts that are being organized right now, you know, all over the world? Is there anything extra that should be done?
It's a larger scale than just the event that the unfortunate event of last night. It's all special events. And in fact, there are many examples in our daily lives where people are in close compaction with each other, whether it's going in and out of malls or situations that might happen on holidays, that kind of thing. And I don't have the answer as we sit here today. We've been on many calls already this morning. There will be many, many more calls. What we focus on is the fact that over the course of the last 10 to 15 years, we've had extraordinary relationships with local, state, federal, provincial resources. We are in constant communication. We collaborate on training. We are working with DHS and other agencies with regard to creating responses to the things we can imagine and the flexibility to adapt to things that we can't imagine. Part of that was evidenced by the I think, spectacular response by the Las Vegas SWAT team from last night, being able to mitigate that threat as quickly as they did.
And how do you think they did that?
I am presuming they did that because they are in constant training. They are constantly looking at the things that might happen and how to react and mitigate those threats. There's less time trying to figure things out, and that gives us a much better, quicker, and more effective reaction.
So you don't think anything will be done differently post Las Vegas?
Well, I think that something's done differently after each one of these events. As we analyze those events and we filter that in terms of what we know and what new types of actions were placed in front of us, there's a large effort now, because of the wide variety of attacks, both on a small and a larger scale, to have more people prepared for active shooter and armed attacker. I think this is something that's difficult for people to talk about, and every person must have a plan. We have to realize that ultimately we're responsible for our own safety, and we're going to have to start to take steps, or at least consider the steps we may take differently in the future.
Do you expect Las Vegas casinos and hotels to install metal detectors in order to get in?
It's really too early for me to speculate on what the mitigation might be, but I think every bit of this will be analyzed in great detail, and where we can find commonalities or opportunities where this could have been identified and responded to. You certainly don't want to be the person that may have had some instinct or some gut reaction that something may not be right and have not said something. And so back to each of our individual and personal responsibilities. This is the reality of the world we live in today, and we need to do our part and make sure that we're paying attention for ourselves and for those around us.
That's Russ Simons, who is managing partner at Venue Solutions Group. Russ, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, in other news, three researchers whose work illuminates the biological rhythm of living cells have won this year's Nobel Prize in Medicine. Jeffrey Hall and Michael Rosbash of Brandeis University and Michael Young of Rockefeller University in New York won for discoveries that peek under the hood of our biological clock, the circadian rhythms that control how our bodies know when it's day and night. That work could have huge implications for our health. Let's bring in Dr. David Clapham. He's a professor of neurobiology and pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and chief scientific officer at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Dr. Clapham, welcome.
Thank you.
And we know that your colleague at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, Michael Rosbash, was among the winners of the Nobel Prize today. What do you think of the committee's choice?
I think it's a great choice. Michael Rosbash, a current investigator, and also Michael Young, a former investigator, were both recipients of the Nobel Prize. And we also congratulate Jeff Hall, who's at Brandeis.
And let's get to what exactly they discovered here. What is a circadian rhythm, and do all living things have them?
Yes. So we're all familiar with circadian rhythms because we all sleep at night and we are awake during the day. We all know that plants, leaves open and close, that cyanobacteria produce oxygen in the daylight. So anything from bacteria to plants to humans all have daily cycles. For example, in humans, body temperature's lowest in the middle of the night. Cortisol levels are lowest in the pre-dawn hours, and then melatonin gets secreted at night.
So circadian rhythms have a big impact on our health.
They do. So we're all familiar with jet lag, for example, or people that work night shifts, that these changes in our circadian rhythm have effects on our health, mainly our ability to concentrate and so forth. But there are more serious troubles, such things as depression and bipolar disorder, obesity, diabetes, all the way to some very serious diseases like fatal familial insomnia, which is just the inability to sleep at all. So it affects our health in many ways.
And these scientists discovered that genes control that internal clock. Tell us about their contribution to the science.
Right. So in the 1980s, Rosbach, Hall, and Young used genetics and molecular biology to find the genes responsible. In the 70s, Seymour Benzer and Konopka at Caltech started using fruit flies to understand flies that had problems in their circadian rhythms. And then Rosbach, Hall, and Young used fruit flies to get at the genes responsible. And they discovered together about six genes from everything from receiving the light that comes in to the genes that turn on and off other genes that regulate cell cycle and cell metabolism and eventually whole body metabolism and health.
So what can we do with that information now? What can this science be used for?
Well, the main things are that, of course, we already do things in medicine with this knowledge, and the things that you're used to, of course, are sleeping pills, et cetera. But what we'd like to get to eventually is to help people with serious sleep problems. For example, as you get older, many people have trouble going to sleep or staying asleep, coming up with the right kinds of medicines, and maybe eventually, for some diseases, altering the genome itself that may be mutant in these kinds of genes.
That's David Clapham, a professor of neurobiology and pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and chief scientific officer at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, talking with us about today's Nobel Prize. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And we continue to follow the mass shooting in Las Vegas. At least 58 people are dead, more than 500 injured. President Trump will visit Las Vegas on Wednesday. He spoke at the White House this morning.
I want to thank the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department and all of the first responders for their courageous efforts and for helping to save the lives of so many. The speed with which they acted is miraculous and prevented further loss of life.
This is special coverage from NPR News of the massacre in Las Vegas. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young, and we have on the line now an eyewitness to this shooting at the Jason Aldean outdoor concert. Dennis Guerrero is a photographer from Montebello, California. He was taking pictures for country station Kix Hot FM in Palm Springs when the shooting started. Dennis, what a horror. Did you, like others, think the gunfire was fireworks? I mean, what'd you think?
Actually, no. I knew it was gunshots, and I had just actually sat down. Jason Aldean was the final performer on the final day of the Route 91 Harvest Festival, and I did our required shots, and I sat down to enjoy the show, and I looked behind me, and I told the gentleman and his wife, I go, was that a gunshot? And he goes, I think it was. And then the lady next to him said, oh, no, it's fireworks for the show. And then that's when the automatic fire started. And that doesn't sound like any fireworks on the planet.
Look,
and that's when everybody...
We have some sound of it, but I'm not even sure. I was going to think, going to say we could maybe play a little of it, because for those who may not have heard, it's pretty incredible. Are you okay with that, if we play a little of it?
Oh, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, well, let's listen to what he heard. I mean, it just...
Right there, before that clip started, it was a pop, and then pop, pop, pop. So from what I'm understanding, that was the first initial shots that we heard. That was the gentleman shooting through the window, I guess. And then when you hear the rapid fire, that's when he just starts spraying the crowd. At that point, I was telling...
I was just going to say, what did you do when you realized what it was?
I was in the ADA section, so my concern was the people that were behind me, because they were all people with disabilities.
Yeah.
So I kind of telling everybody to lay down on the ground, and then flight or fight, were trampling over anybody just to get out the exit. And the thing is that it's such a great venue, because it's hard to explain, but like, if you ever get the opportunity to go to the festival, they have so much security and so much ease of motion. Like, there's one way, there's a lot of ways to get out, a lot of ways to get in. But when the guy's shooting and everybody, the problem was it echoed in there where I personally thought he was in the festival. Hmm. We didn't find out till later that he was shooting down at the festival. And when there was a break between when, I don't know if he was grabbing another gun or reloading, and that's when he told everybody, get up, let's go. And we were all running towards the gate. And then when he started shooting again, we all hit the ground. And as we're running out of the venue, the police and the first responders are running in. And it was just complete madness.
Some of them were shot. Listen, you mentioned you were in the section for people with disabilities, I presume in wheelchairs. How did they get out?
People, that's when you see true humanity in its purest form. Everybody that could was helping. Like, I was carrying a lady with another gentleman. People were pushing the chairs. Everybody was trying to get everybody out. Like, it sounds like an old war movie, but no one was trying to leave anybody behind. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only people that unfortunately didn't make it out were the people that got shot. Like, people were carrying people on stretchers, firemen dragging. I mean, we were all just trying to get out as safely as possible.
How long did it go on for?
Man, it seems like forever, to be honest with you. Between from the first shot to when we actually were able to get out of the parking lot, I want to say maybe 5-10 minutes. And, you know, I did what I think any person would do. I called my wife to tell her I love her, that there was an active shooter, and if I didn't make it home, to tell my kids I love her. And I called my son, who's a Marine, and, you know, he kind of talked me down because I froze. I got scared because they were shooting into the parking lot. And my son said, get in the car, Dad. You got to go. And I got in the car, and everybody's running out, and, you know, random strangers were like, can we get in your car? I had 6 people in my car, and I only got a 4-seater, and I was like, if you can fit, let's go. Mm. And I was about to leave the parking lot. I finally found an exit that it wasn't swamped with people, and the guy in front of me got shot. And the only reason I didn't pull forward was I was letting the last person in my car, and my door and my tire got shot.
Mm. So
that was that.
Well, first of all, I can't imagine. I mean, we just can't imagine. And we thank you so much. We're talking to you live on the radio. You've pulled your car over now, traveling back to California. We really appreciate it. Do you think you're okay? I mean, this was traumatic. You weren't shot, but...
I'm okay. And emotionally, I know I'm still in shock. But... I felt when I go, I shoot many festivals and concerts throughout the year, and this by far is my favorite festival. It's one of the few festivals I invite my family to come to because I feel so safe. Like, when you walk in, there's a police presence, there's security, Live Nation does a great job of making sure it's a family-friendly event. So I felt safe going in, and even in the midst of all this chaos, which they had no control over, the police officers were doing their job, first responders were doing their job, security was making sure everybody that was able on their own or without to get out. But what scared me the most was not knowing where, because my family had left, but I still had friends in the event. And then the people that I had helped get out of the event in my car, they were all, like, no one in the car knew each other except these two ladies, because one was an aunt and the niece, but everybody else was complete strangers, and no one was able to get a hold of their people.
Dennis Guerrero, we thank you so much for talking to us. A photographer from Montebello, California, who survived that shooting in Las Vegas. Please take care.
Yes, and prayers to the family who lost somebody, and I pray for speedy recovery for those who were injured.
Yeah, well, and for you too. Thank you.
Okay.
You're listening to special coverage from NPR News.